Okay, first of all, good evening, everyone. We're very delighted that you're here and very happy to host Rabbi Leder, whom I assume you all know, which is why you're here and why I'm here, because I don't get to usually I don't get to hear him. But I will tonight, and so will you, and we're going to talk about parenting. And Rabbi Leder is going to open, in particular, by the way, parenting in what used to be a culture of excess. But now we've actually solved that parenting problem with a little bit of economic wizardry. And so now we're talking about parenting in a culture of nothingness. Not exactly, of course, because you'll, as you will hear shortly, what is little to us is still a ridiculous amount to most people. And so as we lament our falling 401ks among a world that can't imagine what a 401k even is, we still have a lot of work to do with ourselves and our children. And so I'm going to ask Rabbi Leder to make an opening presentation, and then I'm going to make some comments on it, and then we'll take questions and comments from you. And once again, I'm delighted that you're here, and I'm especially delighted that my friend and colleague, Rabbi Steven Leder, is here to address the question of how to raise children in Beverly Hills. Rabbi Leder.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you all for being here. It is true that that times have changed. I would merely suggest that rather than raising children in a culture of gross excess, we're now merely challenged with raising them in a culture of excess. But trust me, as soon as the liquidity is returned to the credit markets, we will be raising children once again in a culture of gross excess. And it's unavoidable in the world in which we live. Before I say anything about that subject, I just want to thank you, Rabbi Wolpe, for having me here, and thank you for your friendship over the years. I said this at Wilshire Boulevard Temple last week, or the week before, I guess it was, when we were lucky enough to hear Rabbi Wolpe at Wilshire Boulevard Temple. There aren't a lot of people who walk in our shoes in the world. So we take great comfort and support from each other, and I'm honored to be your friend and to be here in your shul. So you have no idea, by the way, how many times people are supposed to go to Wilshire Boulevard Temple and they go to the temple on Wilshire Boulevard instead. So I think I may be the chair of your membership committee. I'm not sure. So. Anyway, I prefer to stand, so let's just get into this. Oh, that's even, wow. See, synagogue you have here, my goodness. Okay, all right, get rid of this. I'm going to talk a little from here and walk around a little. Let me begin by stating the obvious. I started thinking about this book that I wrote called More Money Than God about 7 or 8 years ago, after the dot-com frenzy, and after many years of being a rabbi in a large Reform synagogue and going to far too many bar and bat mitzvah parties. The title of the book, More Money Than God, is meant to be a double entendre. It's meant to be pronounced more money than God. In other words, money has replaced God as the chief deity of our culture. Now, just to give you a sense of how prevalent that is, take any advertising slogan for any product you can think of. Take the name out of the product and put the word God in place of the name, and you will begin to see how the idea of faith in the material rather than the spiritual has become fundamental to our psyche in Western culture. So let me explain it one more time. Take any advertising slogan you know, wow, this is weird how it cuts out, and put the name God in. So for example, like a good neighbor, God is there. You're in good hands with God a better idea? Got God? Take almost any product, any material thing you can think of, and how it is marketed in this country, and you will see that it is marketed and conceived of as having power that Jews believe belongs only to God. And it is impossible to escape that idea in our culture. And this is what our children are exposed to. Before I forget, as I did last week, I always like to, when I'm speaking to a new group, I shouldn't assume that all of you know each other. So I'd like you to just take a moment. I'd like you to turn to someone you don't know, to your right, to your left, in front or behind. And just take just 1 minute, because we're on a very tight schedule tonight. Just take 1 minute and share your net worth with the person sitting next to you, if you wouldn't mind. Just take a minute, and we'll do that. Go right ahead.
Never fails.
Okay. Now, why? Why does that simple request elicit such nervous laughter in this room? I will tell you why. Because no matter how down-to-earth, well-adjusted, menschy, value-centered you may be, no matter how menschy, down-to-earth, value-centered, and balanced any of us may be, all of us, because of the culture in which we live, all of us have somehow fallen prey to the notion that our self-worth and our net worth are related. And if not in our minds, certainly in the minds of others. If I leaned over to my friend and said to him, "Hey, David, this guy in the front row here, over to the far right, what's that guy worth?"
I don't know, but he doesn't give enough.
Everybody knows what I'm asking. Every one of us in this room automatically, by default, assumed I was asking about how much money. You know, it's even so absurd that sometimes I'll say, "Well, what's he worth?" And I say, "Well, you know, on paper or..." Now, we also know, to give ourselves a little credit, that if we pull back for just a moment, we also know that a person's true worth has nothing to do with money. But our first instinct, our default position, when asked about what a person is worth, our automatic response goes to money. We can't help it. So one of my favorite quotes is from Santayana. Santayana said, "I don't know who discovered water, but it wasn't the fish." And what he meant is that we are so immersed in our own reality that we lose perspective, that we really have no sense of ourselves. So this book and tonight is about stepping out of our own reality for just a few moments to have a better understanding of it. And you can see through these few examples how we as a culture, as a society, have privileged the material over the spiritual. Now, don't get me wrong. I am not here to disparage the power of money. I do not believe that money is the problem. In fact, money is the solution to much of what plagues us. And money is the solution to perpetuating many, if not most, of the values we hold dear in the world. Money is not the problem. Money is neutral. It is how it is employed that is the problem. Because money has real power. There's a reason that we have made an idol of money, and the reason is that money has much of the power that we used to ascribe to deity. For example, money can heal you. Try being sick in this country without money. Money can protect you. You know those alarm pads and the guys who come running with their guns? And the gated communities and the security? Money can protect you. Money can heal you. Money can enlighten and educate you. So money has real power. And it is how we employ that power and how our children and grandchildren witness the employment of that power that we're here to talk about tonight. So let's talk now more specifically about children. I'm going to ask some of you to help me. I'd like you to raise your hand, if you're willing to, and share with us the very first memory you have of money as a young child. The very first time you can remember anything related to money as a young child. Just raise your hand if it pops into your mind. Yes, what's your name?
Margaret.
Margaret, tell us. Wait, I'm going to bring the mic over. We'll do the Phil Donahue thing here. Go ahead.
When I was 10 years old, that was in 1943, my father gave me a dollar. I still have this dollar. Wow. I bundle it up, I tell my children about it, and it's in a special hiding place. Wow. $1.
So you felt that you had to bundle up and hide it away?
No.
Why did you keep it? Why was it so special to you? To keep it safe. Money had to be protected.
That $1.
Only that $1?
$1.
Okay. Who else? Let me see. Who else do we have here? Yes.
I have one. I just remembered, I think it was around first grade, my brother and I would play store. And we had, I think, like 2 quarters and a dime. And we'd just keep passing them back and forth, getting tchotchkes from each other's little store.
So you opened a little store with your brother and you bought and sold. How'd that feel?
It was fun. It was super fun.
Wow. Money was super fun. Good. Who else? When you were a little girl, tell me.
When I was a young child, Mother's Day came about, and it was during the Depression. And I wanted very much to buy something for my mother. And my dad said, "We don't have any money." And so he finally scraped together enough money that we could buy her one pair of stockings. And I just couldn't believe that that thing was so important when what I felt was more important.
If I had the night, I would listen to every one of your stories, and here's what we would discover, that 80% of them, 80% of them would be negative, would bring out feelings about money as small children that are negative. Either that money is very exciting, or that money needs to be secreted away, or that money is somehow at the expense of feeling. Mine was the Afikoman. I'm one of five. I have 3 older sisters. They were vicious when I was younger. And I found the Afikoman when I was 5 years old. I have a younger brother, Greg, who was 3. And I grew up at a conservative shul, and Moshe Sachs, our rabbi, had told me in our nursery school that week that whoever found the Afikoman could sell it to the leader of the Seder because the Seder could not be finished without it. And I found the Afikoman. So I went up to my father, who was a blue-collar, working-class, hard-nosed guy, and I said, This was 1965. I said, what? Dahlia, what? Oh, okay. So I said to my father, I want a dollar. Swaggered up to the front of the table and said, I want a dollar. My father said, I'll give you a quarter. And I said, no, but Rabbi Sachs said that you needed it to finish the Seder, so I want a dollar. My father said, now it's a dime. And if that's not okay, I'll take this piece of matzah over here and finish the Seder. And I felt small and belittled and outsmarted with money. When we are teaching our children and grandchildren to ride a bicycle, here's what we do. First, we put them on a tricycle with three wheels that cannot tip over. Then when we think they're ready, we take them to the store to buy their first what? Big girl bicycle or big boy bicycle. And what do we put on that bicycle? Yes, we put or at least we go to the neighbor who has the proper tools because he's a Gentile to put the training wheels. No Jew has the right tools. It's just not possible. So, the next door neighbor has one of those red things with all the drawers, and we put on the training wheels, right? Now, what do we put on our kid? That's true. What do we put on our kids before we put them on the bicycle? A helmet, wrist pads, elbow pads, and knee pads. And then, even though they're padded up and they have training wheels, we still hold on to the back of the seat, and we go like this. And we will do that for months or years. And then, when we think they're ready, we make a ritual out of removing the training wheels. We put the kid on the bike with the helmet, the wrist pads, the elbow pads, and the knee pads. We hold the seat. We run. We go to some empty parking lot on Sunday. We hold that seat. We run behind them. And we launch them into the world and cheer them as they go. Now, we do all of that to help children ride a bicycle, but when it comes to handling money, most parents just give it to their kids and hope it all works out somehow. No training wheels, no pads, no experience. Your children and grandchildren's generation, even with the current decline, are going to inherit more money from one generation of Jews to another than any in all of human history. In the trillions. And they are not equipped. Now, here are the challenges. Here are the two challenges with children, at least as I see them and what I learned in putting this book together. The first is to help children understand that the material is not the spiritual, that our outer lives are not an inner life. I have a 17-year-old daughter named Hannah. I watch Hannah watch television. And here's what she watches. Okay. Biggest Loser. Decorating on a Dime. Pimp My Ride. Cribs, which is basically cameras following young rich kids around, celebrities around, as they show you the crap in their bedrooms. Makeover shows. Oprah with the perfect jeans or the perfect bra or how to lose weight by this or by that. Now, all of these shows have different titles, but they're all the same show. Every one of these shows, every magazine cover, every commercial, they're all the same. They are all selling my daughter and your children and your grandchildren the idea that if you change your outer life, it will change your inner life. And that is crap. That is a lie. There's a reason that people who get cosmetic surgery go back for more and more and more. It's because it doesn't change your inner life. What changes your inner life is generosity and Shabbos and Torah and giving. But children will never know that without us. Parents will talk to their children about almost anything but money. My parents, we get this from our parents. My parents have been married 54 years. My mother knows about my father's hemorrhoids, but she has no idea how much money he has. And he likes it that way just fine. Thank you very much. People in this country will talk about their hemorrhoids before they'll talk about money. It is the last taboo subject in America. And that's why you laughed when I asked you to share your net worth. But we have got to engage with our children vis-a-vis money, because they have only us to weigh in and counteract the negative messages that they are receiving on television and in magazines and in their music. They have only us. Do not count on their schools to do it, unless they go to school here or at Wilshire Boulevard Temple. Do not, I'm serious. Secular private schools and public schools are not going to take this on. Don't count on the schools. They're not going to do it. Children do not understand that money is a finite resource. Most children in this country believe money comes from ATM machines, and if you run out, you just punch the numbers in and you get more. So this is a critical issue. And I want you to think for just a minute about the morning of a bar bat mitzvah. On the morning of a bar bat mitzvah, an anthropologist looking at that bar bat mitzvah, trying to understand what are the values of the Jewish people. You help me. If I had a board up here and I said, what are the values of the Jewish people that you see evidenced on the bima on Shabbat morning? What values would you list as being part of a bar bat mitzvah on Shabbat morning? Just shout them out. Family. Tradition. Prayer. Respect. Honor. What else? Torah. What did you say?
Hard work.
Work. Hard work. Torah. Sacred music. Identity. No, I'm talking about Shabbos morning on the Bima. Commitment. These are our values as a people, and we should be proud of them. But what are the values I would have to list on the board at your usual Saturday night bar bat mitzvah soiree in West Los Angeles? What would list would be on that board? Tell me. Gross excess, booze, sexuality. Have you seen these 13-year-old girls in their slinky black sleeveless dresses? And the totally bewildered 13-year-old boys looking up at them just... Have you listened to the music? Gross excess, booze, sexuality, dancing, and sometimes we hire professional dancers to work the kids up, and believe me, they dress like professionals, if you know what I mean. If you're really lucky, the Laker girls will show up. Now, don't get me wrong, okay? I'm not Amish. Okay? I like single malt scotch. I collect rock and roll photography. I love music. But I'm an adult. I'm not a child. And here's the worst thing. Lots of these kids don't come on Shabbos morning. They're only there for the party Saturday night. So the Gentile kids, the only thing they know about Jewish values is the party. And that is nothing to be proud of. And who writes the checks? The 13-year-olds to pay for all of this? No. You do. We do. And why don't rabbis talk about this more? Because rabbis are afraid of insulting wealthy people, because we depend on wealthy people to keep the shul alive. So there's often this sort of tacit, unspoken agreement. There are also often tacit unspoken agreements with money in marriages. It often goes something like this. You will ignore my workaholism and I will ignore your shopping. It's never said, it's just lived. And our children watch it. So this first compelling and difficult issue that we have to help children weigh in on is this issue, this lie that they're being told that their outer life is an inner life. And the second most important issue is what the Rambam pointed out over 800 years ago, which is the thing that gets most human beings into the most trouble, is we confuse what we need with what we want. And we confuse what we want with what we need. My daughter Hannah informed me a few months ago that she really needed a new pair of jeans. Now, she needed the new pair of jeans because it went something like this. Daddy, I talked to Mommy and we went shopping and I needed a new pair of jeans and she wouldn't give them to me and these are the only jeans I want. I know they're expensive, but I really need them because my thighs are so fat and these are the only ones that work for me and all my friends have them and I don't understand why I can't get them and I really, really need these new jeans. She did it faster than that. And I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. How much are these new jeans? Well, they're $300, but I really need them because they're the only ones that fit me. I said, what are these new jeans called? Guess what they're called? Yeah. True religion jeans for $300. Think about the message to our children. True religion jeans. How sick. And I said, Hannah, do you need them or do you just want them? David saw this last 2 weeks ago, so this is what I got back. Oh. You and your stupid book. I don't care. And here's what I mean by that. We need to be judgmental about materialism with our children. We need to show them the difference between need and want and gross excess and what is appropriate. And here's the crazy thing about it. Well, we'll have a little more fun. David, I know you want me to hurry, but we're going to have a little more fun. Who here has a teenage boy? Who has a teenage boy? Raise your hand if you have a teenage boy. Ah, Betty, I want to pick on you. Come on over here. Come here. Okay. Come here. Come here. Don't be shy. Okay. Teenage boy. His name?
Aaron.
So, Betty, if Aaron came home from school one day and told you to see if he could get a rise out of you, told you an incredibly sexist joke. My son actually tried this a couple years ago with my wife. Came home and told you a really sexist joke. What would you say to him?
That's sexist. I don't want to hear that out of you.
You'd shut him down. That's inappropriate. Thank you. That's inappropriate. I don't want to hear it. It's insulting to me. It's insulting to your grandmother. It's insulting to your family. Don't try that again. Okay, who has an elementary school age girl. Okay. Her name? Lauren. Okay, come here. So Lauren comes home. Okay, Lauren comes home. And she doesn't even know why it was funny, but everybody else in the class laughed. So she comes home and tells you this joke. And it turns out to be, this happened to me in second grade, this turns out to be an incredibly racist joke. What are you going to say to Lauren?
And she's in second grade. I'd say that's completely inappropriate. I don't want to ever hear you say that again.
Okay, completely inappropriate. I don't ever want to hear it again, and I assume you'd explain why. Now, my daughter comes home at 5 years old from her first day at kindergarten, And she says to me, Daddy, Evie's daddy has 12 cars. Now, I have some choices to make. I could say, really? 12 cars? That is fantastic. What kind? Oh my God, I wish we could have 12 cars. Can you go see him? Can I go see him? Oh my God, 12 cars. Does he have a garage that big? That is fantastic. I could do that. Or I could kind of be just sort of benign about the whole thing. Oh, that's nice. Or I could say, Hannah, how many cars can one person drive at one time? And she'll say, one, Daddy. And I'll say, now let's sit down and see what the 11 other cars cost and how many homeless or hungry people we could feed for a month with what those 11 cars cost. I might get the eye roll. And there's a risk in what I've done. What is the risk? The risk is Hannah will go back to school the next day and say, Evie, my daddy thinks your daddy has bad values. My question to all of us tonight is, why will we unquestionably take that risk when it's sexism or take that risk when it's racism, but when it comes to crass excess materialism, we as parents and grandparents feel we are in no position to be judgmental? Now, I know what you're thinking. I just got back from India not long ago. 800 million desperately poor people in India. I spent 6 days in the slums of Mumbai. Compared to every single person in that slum, I am a pig. A gross, materialistic pig. So I know what you're thinking is, okay, Rabbi, we agree with you, but where's the line? How much? How do we know when to call it out to our children and when to let it slide? Are there any lawyers here? Raise your hand if you're a lawyer. I won't pick on you. There's not a single lawyer. What kind of shul is this? You know, closeted. They're closeted lawyers. Okay. One lawyer willing to admit it. Where is the president of the shul? We'll ask him.
There he is.
What's his name?
And he's a lawyer, Ira.
Ira. Does the name Potter Stewart mean anything to you?
Yes.
Yes. Justice Potter Stewart, Supreme Court Justice, is most famous for what?
I know what I see.
Potter Stewart was asked to define obscenity for the court. And you know what he said? I can't define it, but I know when I see it. That's the best I can do for you tonight. You know when you see it. I can't define it for you perfectly, and it is different for every family. We are people of different means and different priorities, and that's fine. But you know it when you see it. And no one will point that out to your children or your grandchildren if not you. Now, I want to end briefly with a comment about the single best thing you can do outside of Shabbat, which I think is actually the most important thing, because that's about divorcing ourselves from the material. I can tell you, as a guy who's had to work pretty hard over the past 3 years to raise money, I can tell in a nanosecond whether or not the person I'm soliciting grew up with generous, philanthropic parents. I can tell in a nanosecond, because the conversation is completely different. So your children need to be a part of your giving. One of the things we did when our kids were younger, you know, we all get these solicitations in the mail for every possible organization, Jewish and otherwise, on the planet. We saved them all. And every December, we'd spread them all out on the table, and our kids would choose with us the things to which we were going to give money that December. What I'm about to say is an odd sentence. the hardest working, most decent billionaire I know. I asked him when I wrote the book, how did you turn out this way? I mean, you work hard every day, you're generous, you're kind, you don't seem screwed up to me. How do you handle this so well? And he said, Steve, my father had me at our family's foundation meetings, sitting at the head of the table next to him from the time I was 5 years old. And if something was happening during the meeting I didn't understand, he would stop the entire meeting and explain it to me. My point is that sometimes when we have some wealth, and all of us in this room do, we somehow think that shielding our children from that reality is doing them some kind of favor. But it is not. It is preventing them from having experience with money, and it is preventing them from being able to learn from your good example. So do not let money be... That's the most beautiful sound possible, by the way, so don't worry about that. You are not doing your children any favors by avoiding these topics. To the contrary, you are empowering them, the next generation of Jews, to be thoughtful and decent. My overwhelming plea tonight is to engage in this conversation with your children, because all of the messages they are getting from our culture are absolutely to the contrary of Jewish values. How'd I do, David? Time-wise, we okay? And I want to end. If I could just, does anybody have a book here? Copy of the book? I know there are a bunch over on the table. Here, Dahlia, can you just toss one? I just want to read a little piece for you from the book. I'm going to end with this, and then we'll hear what Rabbi Wolpe has to say, and then I'll be glad to take questions, and we'll, what do they say, dialogue.
I know. Yeah.
So this is a true story, and I can actually now tell you who this was, because he has since died. This is a true story. This happened to me several years ago. It's a story about John Schlesinger, who was the movie director. He directed Midnight Cowboy and Day of the Locust and all these great, dark, you know, great movies from the 60s and early 70s. So this is a true story, and, you know, it sums it up about as well as I can. A few years ago, I was called to see an extremely famous and wealthy movie director. He was a friend of a friend, and he was in the hospital. We were strangers, this dying old man and I. Entering his room, I noticed amid the monitors, tubes, and fluorescent lights of the sterile ICU, there was only one solitary breath of humanity tacked up on the wall. One small black and white photograph, some 60 years old, of a young couple in their 20s holding hands on a park bench. They were his parents. I entered the room, glanced at the photograph, and then focused on the balding, white-bearded man behind the oxygen mask. His name was John. With a curl of his hand hanging limply off the side of the bed, he motioned me toward him, removed his oxygen mask, and tried to speak. Too weak, he replaced the mask, closed his eyes, rested, and tried again, again, and again. A whisper. A mumble. John, I can't understand you, I told him, but I'm not leaving until I do, so rest, and we'll try again in a few minutes. Finally, pulling me gently down over the bed, John pressed his dry lips against my ear and mumbled a simple question. What's it all for? Suspended in a moment, both eternal and brief, there we were, the dying seeking an answer, the answer of answers, while holding a stranger's hand. a stranger who was supposed to know. My eyes darted to the little black and white picture, then back to John laboring for breath, and with zen-like clarity that surprised me, I uttered a response as simple as his question. "It's to love and be loved," I told him. "They understood that," I added, pointing to the photo. "You're right," John whispered as he closed his eyes and drifted off to sleep. In a way, I felt sorry for John. With all of his success, he was dying alone, asking a stranger what life was really all about. I believe what I told him. A life well lived is filled with love given and received, the ebb and flow of time and generosity. No matter what our net worth, all of us can become rich with family, caring, and laughter. We can all invest and achieve the wealth of friendship. We can all spend less time counting our money and more time counting our blessings. We can all lead richer lives, ever more grateful, simply to love and be loved. Thank you for being here tonight.
First of all, I don't think I need to express on your behalf how wonderful a presentation that was, and how many different sorts of important points Rabbi Leder brought out, although I think that in a practical sense, maybe the most useful is the way in which you can share your giving with your children and let them know what you have and how you make choices about what you have, which very few parents do, curiously enough. And that is, it's an important and useful thing, and it certainly is true that we don't teach our children much about money at all, except to hide it, as we do. What I don't understand, and I'm open to explanations about this, is that there are two, it seems to me that there are two different kinds of psychology that make people ungenerous or extravagant. One is social pressure, right? If you were alone on an island, you wouldn't have an extravagant party. The point of having an extravagant party is to show other people that you can have an extravagant party. There's a tremendous amount of social pressure. And in some ways, the more tied in you are to a social network, the more likely you are to show off your wealth, right? So if that social network is wealthy, obviously. If everybody around you were not wealthy, you would be unlikely to show off your wealth because it would be frowned upon. But as long as it becomes a competition, then what happens is you get people who come to your office, as both Steve and I do, who say, "I can't really afford this bar mitzvah, but I have to do it. So I'm going to go into debt to pay for my kid's bar mitzvah because otherwise everybody will think that I can't afford it." Which, in fact, I can't, but I don't want them to think that, because they'll think less of me and my child will suffer, right? Which is, you know, when you're a parent and you feel like your kid's going to suffer by comparison with other kids, then it's not so easy to say to the parent, "Well, teach your child a lesson by having them have a modest bar mitzvah while everybody else has an extravagant one," because the child does feel that they suffer by comparison. So that's one psychology, is the psychology of competition. The other is in some ways the opposite. It's purely internal. When I go to somebody in the congregation, as has happened more times than I care to count, who, and I don't know someone's net worth, but let's say I know this person has many, many, many tens of millions of dollars or more, right? Have many businesses, many homes, and I say, "Give the synagogue $10,000. And they say, "You know what, Rabbi, it's been a tough year. I'll give you $5,000. And I think to myself, on what basis was this decision made, right? Why did they say 5 instead of 10? It cannot conceivably have any impact, actually, on the way they live their lives, what they'll give their children. 10 days from now, they won't know whether they gave 5 or 10. So on what basis does that, not lack of generosity, but relative lack of generosity, find its expression? And I know that it's not unique to wealthy people because we do the same thing, right? You leave a tip. You could leave $10 instead of 5. You're in a hotel room, and the house, you know, you're supposed to tip a maid in a hotel room. Do you know this, right? You're supposed to tip. Now, do you leave money? And if you leave money, do you leave $1? Do you leave $5? Now, the truth is, if I leave $1 or $5, it's going to make no difference to me, right? I'm not going to notice it in a day, whether I left $1 or $5. So why sometimes do I leave less than I could? And those two aspects of both extravagance and lack of generosity, it seems to me, go to the root in small ways and in big ways of our difficulty with money. That is what we have to show others and the way we have to comfort ourselves. I feel better because I only gave 1 instead of 5. Now, I may only feel better for 2 minutes and then I'll forget about it, right? But that sense of I have more in my wallet, even though it has no practical effect on my life, that sense of comfort is, it seems to me, something that we need to battle against if we're in fact going to teach our children what it is to be generous. It doesn't matter, but the way you can see this best in yourself is not in big things, but in small things, like tipping. Right? For someone whom you liked, not for a waiter you want to punish, but for someone whom you liked, why if you don't tip much, do you not tip much? Because it's not an economic decision. It's something else. It's something else. And I think if we understood that better about ourselves, we'd understand better what our own attitudes are about money and why we transmit those attitudes. So those were at least a couple of my thoughts, and I'm happy to hear your comments on that. So we'll dialogue.
Well, the first one is interesting to me because I don't think that it I think that there's been a cultural shift in a generation. I don't think it speaks to a fundamental human condition, this notion of wanting to display wealth to impress our peer group. I grew up in Minneapolis in Minnesota, and I grew up in a place where the ideal, regardless of your capacity, was to stay one step behind the neighbors. My father never had his car washed because he didn't want it to look nice. It wasn't appropriate.
Right.
So the idea, and let's not idealize Minneapolis, Minnesota, because I just came back from Thanksgiving, and in one generation, that ethic is now gone. Now the ethic is, regardless of capacity, to stay one step ahead of the neighbors. So there is something that has happened, and I think it goes to this notion that we have bought into this belief that our outer material lives are who we are. I mentioned a couple weeks ago when we did the same sort of program at the temple, that there's a philosopher named Jacob Needleman, who I think has written the best, most insightful book on money. It's called Money and the Meaning of Life. It's just a little inaccessible. And he calls this notion that believing that your outer material life is your inner life, is a spiritual life. He says it's like eating a picture of food. It's not so much a sin as it is a mistake. It's just wrong. But I do think that we've fallen prey to this notion that what we have, what we wear, what we look like, what we weigh says something about who we are as a person. How could we not feel that way in this culture? There's a Ralph's across the street from the Hermes campus, so I get a lot of calls at 5:30 from my wife. The worst thing in the world is to work across the street from a grocery store. Emails, you know, red light flashing. Could you just... So I spent a lot of time in the checkout lanes at Ralph's, and I stand there and I look at the magazine covers, and I look at the kids looking at the magazine covers, these airbrushed fembots and these men with perfect abs and billions of dollars, and it's not real, but it is very seductive. So I think we have been seduced. I really do. And I don't know what to do about it other than to call it like we see it. We know it when we see it. And particularly to talk about that with our children. Because showing off is not basic to all human psyches. It's a cultural phenomenon.
Well, showing off is, but not necessarily showing off with
materially,
wealth.
Materially,
right.
If you want to show off with how many block Gomorrah you know, I'm
right,
all for
there's
it.
A lot, right, there's showing off in all sorts of different ways, but I think that part of this, as you were indicating with the magazines, part of it is that the saturation of the media and this and seeking to show things that people will want to see, which is constantly accelerating. You have to show something more extravagant, more titillating, more unusual, more grotesque, more something, is a never-ending search, and that very much shapes, obviously, the culture. But also, of course, as you all know, I mean, we're at the heart of it. Right, you're in extravagant central right here. Not as much as at Wilshire, but so.
Oh man. Oh.
I just said that because you said they went to the wrong Wilshire synagogue. I mean, seriously, the populations that all of us live among and that all of us draw from are exactly that, not just the people who are most shaped by it, but also the people who shape most of it, right? Since this is, for better or worse, the most influential city in the world, because you can write a wonderful book and maybe 100,000 people will read it if you're lucky. If you make a mediocre movie, millions of people will see it. So this is the most influential city in the world, for better or worse, and the images that are generated from here and the culture that is created here is one of visual extravagance, right? That's the whole point, is visual extravagance.
And I actually think that to some degree, it's okay as long as we and our children realize that that is a fantasy, that that is a fairy tale, that that is not real.
The problem is...
But kids can't make those...
It's not just kids. They're too good at it.
Yeah, well, they are.
They're too good at it. The whole point of a successful novel or a good movie is to convince you that the reality you're seeing is in some profound way more real than the reality you live. That's what I mean...
Right.
And it works with a successful, for a lot of people, it used to be, I mean, let's take a classic example. Hamlet was more real than their next door neighbor. They lived his struggles more profoundly. And the same thing is true for a lot of, I mean, look, I have a 12-year-old daughter, okay? She is about to be 13. She is in love with Edward. And if you don't know who Edward is, you haven't read the Twilight books. Now, she knows, A, that Edward is a fictional character, and B, that there are actually no beautiful vampires, right, walking around the hills of Los Angeles. But the success of art is to implant the mythic very deeply, even though you know intellectually that it's not true, right? Even though you know that. So I think that to say... You got to know that it's a fantasy, especially when, by the way, a lot of it isn't a fantasy, because reality shows have now swept across so that you're actually saying, even if the reality shows are scripted, this is real. It won't work.
It's a very serious problem, and we do have antidotes to that problem. The vast majority of Jewish mythology and lore is an antidote to that problem. To be here second day Rosh Hashanah, because we have a relatively small service second day at our place, and I got confused and I went to the temple on Wilshire instead of Wilshire Boulevard Temple, and here I was. I didn't have a ticket. Howard $180 and let me in the door. Credit card, no cash. Anyway, I was lucky enough and to hear David speak, and the story, I think it was the Dubrovnev, the Magid of Dubrovnev story, was so powerful, I thought. and so true to our tradition, and so insightful in terms of what we need to, the narrative that the Jewish people needs to continue to establish. And I want you to tell the
story.
I want you to tell the story.
If you weren't here on Rosh Hashanah, you don't know the story.
I'm telling you, this for me was the moment where it crystallized everything.
It will cost you, by the way, it's $180 to hear the story.
Yeah.
Dahlia will take the money on the way out. But so the Maggid of Dubnov tells the following story. She says, a father and a son were on their way to Cheder, to Jewish religious school, when all of a sudden they heard trumpets and horses and jingling bells, and everybody stopped, and a huge, magnificent coach came along, and it stopped in the middle of the street, and everybody was staring at it with awe, and out strode this Polish nobleman in furs and jewels, and attended by all these people on right and left with beautiful white horses on the coach, and he stepped down regally, and the father leaned over and he said to his boy, pay very close attention, because if you don't study Torah, you could turn into that. It's a great story.
That is a great story, because it gets to the heart of the seduction and how antithetical that is to what it means to be a Jew. I will tell you one quick story, just quickly, similar story, joke, and then we'll take some questions if that's okay.
Absolutely.
So there's a rabbi and his son walking down the street, and they see a drunkard lying in the street in the gutter. And the drunkard's son is also drunken and lying in the gutter in the street. The rabbi's son looks at his father and says, look, not only the father, but the son too is a drunkard. To which the rabbi replies, I can only hope that I'm as great an influence on you as that man has been on his son. So in other words, we have the power to influence our children with the values of our tradition. Let's use that power.
Questions? Yes, please. Stand up if you're going to ask. Go ahead. Peers.
Well, let me tell you what we do at the temple, okay? First of all, I talk about this bar mitzvah party issue with all of the families in fourth grade, about 170 families every year, to the children with their parents, and then I do it again 9 months before the bar bat mitzvah, number one. Number two, and this is not unique by any means, all our kids have a tikkun olam, very heavy, serious tikkun olam requirement. Now, this is something really interesting. We had a member of the congregation whose son tragically died, and this son had devoted his life to fighting white-collar crime. And they came to me and said, Steve, we want to make a significant contribution to the temple, but we want to do it to honor Jordan and honor the values he stood for. So I said, here's what I think we should do. Let's partner with the URJ and use their education staff, and let's author a curriculum on business ethics for children, grades K through 6. And we'll do it in our elementary school, our religious school, and at our camps. An actual curriculum that talks about being an ethical person in business. I mean, Joe Telushkin's made a living out of the four questions we're asked when we die, the first of which is, were you honest in business? So we actually have a curriculum in our day school, in our religious school, and at our camps that deals with being responsible with other people's money and not lying and not cheating. And so, yes. But I agree with part of your point that children don't always listen to us, but they are always watching. Do not walk past homeless people without giving them money because I'm such a nice guy. I give them money because my children are watching.
Yeah.
One child picked up trash here in the suburb where they live, and the other kid went to Argentina and gave
family didn't have. The rabbi had to think about that congregation, and it was interesting what he said, but I think this whole mitzvah project is wonderful, but I think it lets you make the kids do something on their own without the parents saying, here's all the gifts we're going to give you, and you're going to take these gifts and give them to someone else.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, it's neutral unless it's properly employed. Yep.
Okay. Peter?
You said in your talk that clothing among kids is quite significant. And there's also competition among kids, especially among girls, about what they wear. There's not a
exactly. Yeah.
Why is that? Because there's a reluctance to require kids in school.
All our kids wear uniforms, and my kids go to school. My son's now in college, and he has a uniform. It's just jeans down around his ankles with his boxer shorts hanging out. But my daughter goes to a school. She goes to the Archer School for girls, and they wear uniforms. And part of the reason we sent her to an all-girls school is to avoid some of the social pressure. Although it's very clear to me that women dress not for men. They dress for other women. But that aside, our kids in our elementary school all wear uniforms. And, you know, that's the deal. And if they don't like it, they can go someplace else. By the way, they do like it. And it is, I think, the right thing to do for all kinds of reasons, not the least of which is getting your kid out of the house in the morning.
Yeah. Okay. Gary?
Not on the weekend, it doesn't. No, sir. It only absolves us. Well, the other thing, you know, I do agree that the primary responsibility rests for the parents, but we also, as an institution, try to do what we think is right. And also, we have a lot of kids who are scholarshiped in our school who can't afford the clothing that other kids can afford. And this is a way that just removes that whole issue 5 days a week. Trust me, and you're going to see. I mean, trust me. It's still a major issue. It's also an issue of what is appropriate, not just in terms of cost, but modesty, which is a whole nother issue.
Go ahead.
They find a way. Yeah. Yeah, they find a way. Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah. Oh, is that? That was one. Go ahead. My favorite too, actually. It's amazing. I felt. That's nice.
Yeah. That's beautiful. That's great. You know,
Okay, go ahead. That
leads to a quick point that I want to make, which is the when we're not sure what's right, how much is too much, etc. We also ask ourselves how much should we give and how much should our children give. Our tradition has a very clear answer for 3,500 years. We tithe 10%. Adjusted gross, thank God, but it's 10%. It's simple. Simple.
Okay, let's take two more. One, two, well, three more. One, two, three. Go ahead. One. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you. You can go back to that.
Yeah. Go ahead, two. Yes.
So I'm just curious with your daughter.
Yeah. God, she would be so pissed if she knew we were talking about her right now. If any of you have kids at Archer, you better keep it quiet. That's all. Yes. Knock yourself out. Go ahead. And the money's gone. Gone once you spend it. You know? We always gave our kids their allowance, whoever said they do it, $50 a week. We gave it all to them on the first of the month because we knew they would squander it and they would run out of money before the month was over and they would want more and we would have the opportunity to say no. So that they had to learn to defer and delay gratification. Because one of the very, very dangerous traps with children and money is this, well, let me just put it very simply. An addict said to me one time, instant gratification wasn't quick enough for me. Instant gratification wasn't quick enough for me. So we've tried to teach our children to delay gratification, which I think is a very important message. And also to teach them that when you are out of money, you are out of money. Because kids don't believe that money is finite. They don't believe it.
Neither does the government, by the way. Yes, go ahead. Three. And four. Go ahead.
Oh, wait, can I just say, I'm sorry, but that is why this economic crisis has hit people so hard. Because the liquidity market has drawn up, credit has dried up. So people actually now have to live on what they make. And they're shocked. They're literally shocked that they have to live on, they're you know, incredulous. They're upset. I only get to spend what I make? This is America. That's awful. Well, that's just real. That's just real.
Go ahead.
Exactly.
How old is she? That's actually, when you say you want to cry for her, one thing that we know from ourselves is that all the most valuable lessons that all of us have learned in life have come from pain. And because we are so intent on preventing our children from feeling any pain, what we're effectively doing is depriving them of the opportunity of learning the way we learned. And if you live without pain, then when pain finally comes, you can't stand it. So we have set them up for a life where the inevitable hardships of life will destroy them because they've never learned from smaller hardships. So don't let your heart break for her. Mm-hmm. It was a good thing for her to learn.
We can't afford it is really a valuable thing for children to hear. And now, what do you do if you really can't afford it, but you don't think it's right? And so let me just tell you what I found helpful to say to my children when they were younger. I used to say, we're an either-or family. We can either do this or we can do that. We need to make choices. I say to our staff at the temple, we can afford anything. We can't afford everything. So we have to make choices. And I think that that's a very appropriate lesson for companies, for synagogues, for families, and for children.
That's why I always say, you have to make choices, Howard. I don't have to make, you have to make choices. Yes, okay, last question. Go ahead.
It The question was, how open, you know, since I'm advocating a greater sense of openness with our children about money and what we do with money and what it's for and what it's not for, should we be equally open, you know, with the larger community? And I will tell you, I would appreciate a great deal more openness in Los Angeles than exists, because there is almost no peer pressure when it comes to giving in Los Angeles like there is in other communities. In the community where I grew up in Minneapolis, if you didn't give, everyone knew you didn't give, and they leaned on you to your capacity. Nobody was, you know, shaking anyone down or being untoward or unkind, but it was simply unacceptable not to be a part of the community. And you know, I often ask people, I'll say, would you please share with your friend so-and-so what you're doing? Or would you at least allow me to share what you're doing so that we can encourage her to do that as well? So I don't think you want to, you know, I just keep thinking of that Larry David episode with Anonymous and Ted Danson. I'm Anonymous. I was Anonymous. If you didn't see it, it was just hysterical. But I wish there was a little more peer pressure in the community to be generous.
I'm going to give Rabbi Leder a chance to make a final statement, but before I do, I just want to give you one instance of peer pressure that one of my teachers told me about. Eliezer Shlomovic, who was a wonderful man and a wonderful teacher who passed away a few years ago, was my teacher in Midrash and in Talmud at what is now AJU, at American Jewish University. And I was in his office one time, and he was talking about giving in the town in which he grew up in Eastern Europe, in Slotvina. Now, you know that according to Jewish law, after a woman has her period, she has to go to the mikveh before she can have sex again with her husband. He said, in Slotvina, if someone didn't give, they wouldn't let his wife go to the mikveh. And they would not let her go to the mikveh until he gave. Now, that technique may not be as effective today as it was then, but what is most interesting about that is that they had no compunction whatsoever about using the most severe communal stricture that they could think of, right, to get somebody to give, and they thought that that pressure was completely appropriate. Nobody said, how dare you interfere in their family, right, in their family dynamics in order to get a gift to the synagogue. Everybody thought that was perfectly fine, and if you can think of a modern analog, I invite you to speak to our development director.
So here it is. Here's the analog. Here's the analog. There was a small village in Poland, and their milk cow died. And they could get a milk cow from Moscow for 300 rubles or a milk cow from Minsk for 200 rubles. So they buy the milk cow from Minsk, they bring it to the village, they put it in the pasture. Unbelievable milk cow, copious amounts of milk. Incredible. So they decide, you know what we should do? We should buy a bull now and mate the bull with the milk cow. We'll have a lot of milk cows and the village will never go hungry again. So they buy the bull, they put it in the pasture. The problem is, when the bull approaches the milk cow from one side, the cow moves to the other side of the pasture. When it approaches from that side, it moves to the other side. When the bull approaches from the rear, the cow moves forward. When the bull approaches from the front, the cow moves backward. They don't know what to do, so they go to the rabbi. They say, Rabbi, we don't know what to do. We have this milk cow, which is fantastic. We want more of them. We've got the bull. We put the bull in the pasture. When the bull comes from behind, the cow moves forward. The bull comes from the front, the cow moves backward. The bull comes from the side, the cow moves to the side. We don't know what to do. The rabbi says, let me ask you a question. This milk cow, is it from Minsk? They can't believe it. They're shocked. They said, you are an amazing rabbi. We never told you. How did you know the milk cow was from Minsk? The rabbi looks at me and says, my wife, she too is from Minsk.
Thank you.
So now that I have brought the level of discourse down, I do want to say one thing. Yeah.
Before you do, Peter's book is available at the door. We hope that you will spend some of your hard-earned money.
So here's what I want you to do. I want you to buy a book as a Hanukkah gift for someone, because this is the antidote to the excess of Hanukkah. And share it with someone. Either get it for yourself and read it and pass it on, or share it with someone. But I hope that you will. The books are $20, and buy them. I'll sign them, buy them, give them away, and I want to really thank all of you for being here tonight, and please go forward. Thank you.